This Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit ShareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.
Hello and welcome to the Twin Peaks Investing Podcast. This is podcast number 175, and I'm here today with a very, very special guest. I've got Dr. George Cooper of Equitile, and he's the Chief Investment Officer. And I've also got my fantastic co-host, Henry Viola here, as per usual. We've got a special podcast today for you, ladies and gents, around the world. We're going to talk about the investing world with regards to private credit and the possible private equity risk that's out there, which not enough people we think are talking about. And I've got an expert who knows all about this because he was there way before the Lehman crisis with over 30 years experience, and in Dr. George Cooper. I'm going to allow George to introduce himself and tell you all about his 30 years of working in senior investment strategy roles at prestigious firms, including Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank, and Bluecrest Capital. Hi, George. Want to tell our audience a bit more about yourself, please?
Hi, Peter. Okay, so a potted history of myself. I've worked at all of the firms you've just mentioned. About 10 years ago, in fact, almost exactly 10 years ago, myself and a few colleagues got together and founded Equitile Investments, which we've been running the Equitile Resilience Fund, a global equity fund, for 10 years now, with some considerable success. That's doing very well. But before I launched Equitile to focus on, as I said, the equity strategy, most of my previous roles, actually, I was in the debt markets, the debt capital markets, the bond markets. And while I was in those roles, I had various fund management roles and strategy roles. And I became particularly interested in monetary policy and the conditions that create credit bubbles, and the conditions that allow those credit bubbles to then turn into financial crises. Back in, I think it was 2007, just before Lehman Brothers failed, I wrote a book called The Origin of Financial Crises, which describes how these credit bubbles form and how they then go on to destabilize the economy and the equity markets and the bond markets broadly. So I think we're probably jumping ahead on the podcast, but some of the conditions that were in place when I wrote that book before the global financial crisis are looking quite similar today. So that's a sort of a lead in.
Brilliant. Thank you. So whilst we've moved on a little bit further than I wanted to be at this stage in the podcast, can you touch on some of the conditions you were seeing back in 2007 before Lehman happened, so we can get abreast of when we go forward to this podcast where what you might be seeing now, please?
Okay, well, what had happened in the run-up to Lehman was that we'd had a very long period of economic stability, very long period without recessions, a very long period, therefore, where investors get confident, they get complacent. And what happened particularly in the bond markets was that there was a phenomenon going on to do with securitized mortgage lending. And this is basically, it was centered around the US housing market, but it did manifest itself in other countries. But basically what was happening was mortgage lenders were becoming very lax with their lending standards, being willing to lend very high multiples to people that basically couldn't afford the mortgages to buy houses in the belief that basically the housing market in the US never really went down. That was the mindset at the time. So the collateral that was backing these loans was always safe. This went on for a number of years. Banks became very enthusiastic to get involved in this as a profit center. They started even buying the mortgage origination companies so that they could then pre-package the mortgage loans into mortgage bonds, and then sell those on. And in that process, there was a lot of what economists call principal agent problems, which is where the people involved in the chain don't necessarily have the same interests as the buyer of the bonds. So we've got a lot of parallels in the private debt space with this. We've got agents involved in originating these loans, packaging them into private debt funds, and selling them on to investors, and they don't necessarily feel the same commitment as the investor, if you like. And the investor themselves, because of this process of several stages of intermediaries, the investors don't necessarily have the right information about the quality of the loans either, which is the same thing that was happening with the mortgage market before the financial crisis hit.
Brilliant explanation now. Thank you ever so much. I'm conscious that Henry's got lots and lots of questions for you. I've had a quick look at this, and I've been talking about it on X, hence the reason why we're having this conversation. Henry's been looking at it for a couple of months now. I've been looking at it more recently, and we had a thread going with John Stepek, Mark Dampierre, and several others, interacting up with the thread. And we've now had a major piece written in the Daily Mail on Mail on Sunday. And I think also John Stepek and Marion did a podcast on it as well, as we'd already booked this one in. I thought we'd proceed with it. But the private equity market or private credit market in the US currently sits around 3 trillion, and the UK private credit market currently sits around 2 trillion. For the size of the UK, that's quite a significant amount, if I've got my sums right or the data I found is correct. But the domino effect, as you've touched on there with what happened in 2007-8, were that to happen again, I think the visuals and the aspects that we're looking at regarding the Straits of Hormuz and the Iran war could be equal or even worse as a domino effect across the world. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I mean, you've got potentially we've got two things happening at once. We've got an energy shock, which, we've seen this movie several times before. What does an energy shock do? Well, it pushes up inflation and it diverts consumer spending power away from other things into energy. They've got to pay their fuel bills, so they can't spend elsewhere. So that tends to undermine economic activity, diverts corporate profits from one area to another. So that creates all sort of problems in the economy. If we're hitting the economy with a big energy shock at the same time that we've got this sort of simmering private asset story, and I would say it's a bit broader potentially than just private credit. I think it is private equity as well. I think it's private assets. So you do have the risk of a double whammy, and that could be difficult to digest. Now, the other thing that we've got to think about in this scenario is when the global financial crisis hit, with a small lag, and it was only a small lag, governments stepped in and started doing all sorts of quantitative easing. I mean, this is where the term quantitative easing comes from. They started buying assets and they started pouring money into the capital markets to stabilize things. At least they did once they realized the consequences of letting Lehman Brothers go bankrupt. So they started injecting a lot of money, and that That's more or less in different phases been running ever since. We've had big fiscal deficits in different waves all the way through. As a consequence, we find ourselves now sitting at a point where we've got these couple of problems potentially hitting the economy, and the governments themselves are already sort of up to their eyeballs in debt and already running big deficits. So if they're called on to start needing to stabilize another problem, what happens to the government debt markets? That, you know, that's the next domino, if you like.
Brilliant. No, thank you for that response and reply. Henry, do you want to start with a few of your questions, please, mate? I know
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
want
Well, I mean,
to have
first
a
of
couple of
all,
answers here.
I realize you've been going for a few minutes, George, but thank you very much for joining us. I suppose my role on the podcast often comes back to trying to link the topic of the day to what our audience are looking to see. And we've got a lot of retail investors that listen to us. And I suppose the starting point for a lot of them is going to be, you know, for those that don't follow private markets closely, private equity and private credit, what are these markets? How would you define them? Well, your audience won't follow them closely because they can't, because that's the clues in the word, they're private. So the difference between the private equity markets and the private debt markets and what's called the public debt and equity markets is that the public markets are quoted. So you can look up the prices that the companies are trading at. It's a little less clear in the bond markets, but you can look up the prices that bonds are trading at as well. And as a result, you can get a measure from those prices of what the rest of the investment community are thinking about those instruments. You can see, people are starting to worry about the credit quality of this bond or the profitability of this equity. Private markets don't have that feature. You don't know what the prices are. You can't track them. We don't really know even how much there is out there. The stats that Peter quoted at the beginning, they're good guesses, but the markets may be bigger than we expect.
As they were in 2007 and 2008, exactly.
Exactly. Yes. So we don't really know how big they are. Now, why it's interesting to sort of backpedal a little bit and ask why have these markets developed? In a way, they've developed as a sort of echo of the global financial crisis, because what happened when people realized what had been going on with the global financial crisis, governments that were then called on to sort of pour a lot of money into the markets then also responded by increasing regulations, particularly on the banking sector, on the lenders. And as they increased the regulation in the banking sector, what effectively emerged is this shadow banking system, which is what it is. The private debt market is a shadow banking system. So you have institutions that have emerged, private debt funds, which effectively take in deposits. They're not deposits, but they're money from investors. They take in money, they lend it out to the companies that want to borrow. And in some cases, and this is where there is potentially a connection back into the public markets, and in some cases, they also borrow money from the traditional banking sector. So it's not a simple thing where we can just say with confidence it's private. These investments are owned by a group of private individuals. They're generally wealthy because that's the nature of private investments. So if there's a problem in that market, it doesn't matter. The rest of the economy is fine and the man on the street's fine. The connections we may find, and we usually do find when crises emerge, is that the connections in the system are stronger than we expect, and they do feed back into the main banking system, if you like.
Right. And that was kind of my first question to you, because you've summed it up quite nicely. It sounds to me as though potentially you've got banks that have got links, you've got insurers that have got links, you've got asset managers that have got links. Any financial institution that is listed on a market and has access to capital could have put funds into these private credit funds and therefore could have exposure.
So you've named two that particularly worry me: insurance companies, but also pension funds. So another feature of the private markets is, as I said, you can't tell the price of the assets because they're private; they're not
There's no
quoted.
price discovery mechanism.
Yeah, there's no price discovery mechanism. Now that's a feature that, believe it or not, a lot of investors find very, very useful, because they can buy these assets, they can put them on their balance sheet, and guess what? They stay on their balance sheet at the same price. So there's no volatility. So again, when regulators responded to the global financial crisis, one of the responses was you have to tighten up your risk assessments. You have to pay more attention to asset volatility. That encouraged everybody to encouraged insurers and pension funds to get out of the equity markets and go into the bond markets, which are lower volatility, and then encourage them again to go out of the listed bond markets, which have volatility, to go into the private bond markets, because they can just look at their spreadsheet day after day, and it looks like everything's the same price.
But surely that lack of price volatility isn't really a measure of security. It's more just a lack of transparency. It doesn't mean that the asset is worth what you've got it booked at. It just means that nobody's checking what the value is.
Exactly that. I have heard it called, quite a nice phrase, volatility laundering.
Okay, yeah.
Which I think nicely sums up the issue. So it's a convenient thing for investors, but it does run the risk that maybe the problems in the system are bigger, and we don't know until a decent number of investors try to sell. They try to reduce their positions, then you get some price discovery, and guess what? That's what we're seeing now. We're
And this
seeing
is
funds.
where firms like BlackRock and Blue Owl have started gating funds because they couldn't realize the assets at the
Yeah.
value they got them booked at, and therefore couldn't realize enough cash to give back to the investors.
Exactly that. So they're gating their funds because they can't sell the assets at anything close to the prices that they claim the bonds are worth, or the debt is worth. And that can lead to a cascade effect where others look at that and go, oh, I need to get out as well. So you can get a market effect which is different to the economic reality. In other words, maybe these loans are as good as the private debt managers say they are. That almost doesn't matter. If you've got enough investors panicking, then their value is going to be lower than they expect, regardless of the fundamentals of the loans themselves. So we've got a bit of that situation emerging now, where there's a rush for the exit, and there isn't a new buyer on the other side. In fact, I've witnessed in the last couple of months a phenomena which is being called the democratization of private assets, which is a lovely euphemism for the industry collectively trying to create yet more vehicles to make these private assets available to the mom and pop, the guy on the street. That I think is very risky. These assets shouldn't be held by that type of investor. So that's one thing I would say. The other thing I would say is another connection back into the real economy. Because they're held in pension funds and insurance companies, if there's a problem, then you get a problem in the insurance industry and you get a problem with pension valuations. And that with a lag, that would impact people's perception of their wealth. It would impact their real wealth and their perception of their wealth, and that changes consumption patterns as well.
This all
Yeah, well,
sounds faintly
can I just
terrifying.
it is, and can I just speak to you about this? You've sort about it, talked about just trying to get it into retail investors now, so it becomes public debt, and exposure to it. And Henry tweeted a post, I think it was it yesterday, Henry, regarding the London Stock Exchange launch of Goldman Sachs's World Private Equity Return Tracker. Yeah. And I think your comment, what was your comment again regarding that?
I
Not
said I'm
entirely
not entirely.
convinced this is the best timing, right? I'm not sure you saw this particular launch, Dr. Cooper, but this is precisely what you say. They're trying to get it into more and more and more vehicles.
So they're now looking for, they're looking to create the buyer that they need. When they've got the existing investors that are looking to get out, they need to sell those assets to somebody else. And there isn't a somebody else at the moment. So they're trying to create that new demand and they're trying to give that to essentially retail investors.
Wow.
This is a quick hello to you, our valued Twin Peaks Investing Podcast listener. Whatever channel you're listening to, please make sure to subscribe and you'll always be the first to get the new episodes. Thank you for your continued support.
Wow, I'm sat here going, Henry, what thoughts on that? Are you going to go and buy any of this?
I am absolutely not. Personally, I'd rather set fire to money in the street than buy that fund. But I think you raise a really interesting point here, George, because the average retail investor is really fairly uninformed about the mechanisms by which these vehicles are created. So you identified at the beginning of this conversation that somebody out there is originating these loans and these private equity deals. The retail investor will never meet that individual. So you don't know under what terms they're really operating. You've then got these fund structures, so the Goldman Sachs Global Equity Tracker, for example, which presumably has gone and selected a basket of assets from somewhere. My guess would be inside the Goldman Sachs, monstrosity. Now, how have they selected those assets? Because my guess would be these are probably, like you say, assets that somebody wants some money back, they can't sell them, and therefore they've just sort of put them into a new vehicle to realize some cash. I'm not sure that your average retail investor will really have thought that through. They think they're just being offered this new shiny basket of exciting loans.
So what they will probably be seeing is the basket of loans presented with the track record of how those loans have performed over the last 5 or 10 years.
Very stable, low
Yeah,
volatility.
very stable, low volatility, and the reason they've performed like that is because they're private assets. They haven't been, marked to
No one's
market
been
regularly.
benchmarking them. Yeah.
And they won't be told that they are being offered this now because there is this problem. So, the famous saying, past performance doesn't predict future returns. There's probably no time better than now to pay attention to that phrase.
And also buyer beware.
Yeah.
Yeah. So George, given that we've got the Americans who very rarely want to IPO and list anything in the UK, are coming over to the UK to list this particular vehicle as a tester. Yeah. What does that mean with regards to the actual potential implosion that's sitting there bubbling under the surface like Mount Vesuvius, ready to go off, regarding the debt levels, regarding private credit debt and the market over there. What are other people talking about it in the US that we're not aware of? And should more people be talking about it here in the sense of making us aware that the domino effect could be happening again, regarding what happened in 2007, 2008?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, look, if you're doing anything in the debt markets, your first port of call is always the US market. Yeah, it's the deepest debt market. It's the best developed capital market in the world. If you're starting to look to the UK market, you're doing it for a reason. And that is that you're short of investors, probably.
Right.
So you want to find other investors. There are other issues. You could argue that maybe the UK and the European investor base are traditionally more cautious than the US, so they might be more, inclined to look at the debt markets. But generally speaking, I would say it's probably they need, given the size of the private debt market that they're looking for the new buyer for, if you like. They need to cast the net as wide as possible. So that's probably why they're coming to the UK as well.
Brilliant. Thank you for that response. So this is one of the questions that Henry put together. If the private credit, if private credit runs into trouble, who gets hit first in the listed markets, and which quoted sectors should investors be watching most carefully that have over leveraged and exposed to that?
Okay, so of the listed entities, the ones that are most connected to this are the group of fund managers that specialize in managing these private debt funds. So there's a group of those. They're mostly in the US. They're likely to be the first port of call, and their share prices have shown some distress already.
Yeah.
After that, I would say your next connection is probably into the traditional banking system. As I said, although these are private debt instruments, some of the funds have leveraged themselves up by borrowing from the banks in order to increase their returns. So there is a connection into the banking system. So I would say that's a potential other area. It's one that we're looking at particularly closely for our investments generally. After that, there's a broader issue, and that is, I think people don't often realize what credit does to an economy. Basically, when you've got credit expanding, when the economy is increasing the amount of debt that it's using over time, what that tends to do is drop pretty much directly through to corporate profits. So when you've got a credit boom, you've usually got a corporate profit boom. When the economy tries to go into a credit contraction, you usually get a corporate profit problem. That's what happened in the global financial crisis. So that would be the next and sort of bigger connection. If the credit creation engine stalls, so the private credit origination process stalls, and we've got to remember what a lot of private credit has been used to fund, which is the data center boom, the AI boom, things like that. If the private credit markets stall, then probably those asset booms or maybe even bubbles, they will stall, and that will then ripple through into the rest of the economy, employment, labor markets, and as I said, corporate profits.
And those stocks, those mega stocks that have all been, virtually financial engineering all the different investments that they've been making. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's another symptom that I think is pointing to problems in this area. When you start to get what's what was famously called around the original NASDAQ bubble time, around 2000, vendor financing, where a company starts to provide its customers the money to buy its own products. Then you're basically sort of bootstrapping, and that's a problem. And that happens when the equity markets are so euphoric about the value of the company that it's got such a high share price, so the multiple that the market is willing to put on the revenue generated by that company is so high that it becomes economically viable for the company to say, well, you know what, if I earn a dollar, the market is going to say that that dollar is worth $100. So I can spend $2 to buy that dollar of revenue by funding my customer, even though the whole circuit is loss-making. So there are, I'm not going to name names and companies specifically on a podcast because that might get me into trouble, but there are sectors of the economy that look very, very like that at the moment.
Love that response, George. Thank you ever so much. Henry's sitting there absolutely like transfixed. Henry, go. What have you got?
I love it, George. I mean, the way you're summarizing this is it's wonderful. I mean, I guess one of the other things that I'm very cognizant of listening to this is, oh my goodness, well, if the banks are in trouble and the insurers are in trouble and the asset managers are in trouble and that's going to lead to a knock-on in the real economy, what on earth does the private investor do? Where does the retail investor go from here? Do we sell everything and hide? I mean, we can't give specific recommendations on this podcast, but I'm curious, is there any safe haven?
Yes, I think there are. So, if we step back far enough from this, what will happen as a result of this problem? It's what happens after a result of all of these debt problems. Although the governments are, stretched, to use a very polite euphemism, they're far beyond stretched. What the governments will do is respond with more quantitative easing. They will start to lean on the central banks to keep rates lower than they should. I'm not saying necessarily they will cut rates, but they will probably not increase rates as much as they should, given the inflation pressures coming through from the oil markets and things like that. So that will lead to a form of monetization. So they start pumping money into the system, leaning on their central banks to make that affordable by keeping interest rates down. What does that do? The risk is it turns into a sort of 1970s inflation cycle. So if that's the scenario, what do you do about it? Hard assets. So you want, and I should say, in the long run, actually equities do very well out of this because the equity is the inflation protected asset. So equities actually do okay. There will be some very big bumps on the road, but equities come out of this process in good shape. Where you have to really worry, and this has been a long-held concern of mine with the British pension industry. The British pension industry has just run in one direction for decades towards bonds, very long-dated bonds. The scenario I've just described is disastrous for bonds, for the real value of bonds, because they won't keep up with inflation. So I think there are places to hide, and in fact, even do better than hide. There are places you're going to benefit from this, which is you need to be seeking inflation protected assets. Equities are the best place to look. And I would say, I can tell you broadly what I'm doing is looking for assets that are tied to tangible things that the government can't print.
I love that. I absolutely
Yeah.
love that. I've got a very similar thesis, not necessarily driven by specifically by the private credit markets, but as long as governments print money, hard assets will inflate, and therefore over time, the best thing that you can do, in my opinion, is to avoid sitting in cash, and bond-like structures because they just lose value over time.
Yes, cash and bonds. I mean, bonds, I'll tell you what I call them, certificates of charitable giving. Basically, if you buy a long-dated government bond, you're basically making a charitable donation to the Treasury.
And it's what the governments rely on,
Yeah.
absolutely rely on it.
Yeah. And there's in finance, if you read a finance textbook, they describe bonds as the risk-free asset.
They're
Okay.
far from risk-free.
That is the biggest misnomer anywhere in finance.
Very true. So I suppose moving on slightly, an awful lot of our listeners, I mean myself included, are quite drawn to income from the stock market. You know, we like our dividend payments, we like that source of income. But one thing that Peter and I have seen again and again and again is private investors reaching for yield without really understanding what's driving it. Is private credit part of a pattern in which investors have sort of reached for yield without understanding the risks underneath? And what are the warning signs that they should be looking for to check that yield is sustainable?
Oh, that's
Great
a
question, isn't it?
yeah, that's a great question. It's a big question. It goes beyond private credit because it's also in the debt markets and in the high dividend paying stocks. You know, there's that whole sort of cohort of assets. I don't think there's an easy answer to that. There are different scenarios where it can be perfectly reasonable. You can go for that strategy and it works out. There are problems in the equity markets where you go for high dividend stocks and you get into what's called a dividend trap, where the problem with the problem with dividends from a corporate point of view is there is a mindset in the equity markets that the dividend should be fixed or upwardly resetting only. So when a company cuts its dividend, it's seen as a very negative thing. So as a result, a high dividend company can tend to hang on to its dividend for too long, even after its economic conditions have started to deteriorate. And as a result, they start to actually increase their debt levels in order to fund the dividend. So in that scenario, what the equity investor is getting is not really a dividend. They're actually getting paid part of their capital back, and the company is borrowing money on their behalf to pay them their money. So I would say watch for that sort of scenario.
Yeah.
If you're holding a portfolio of dividend companies and some of those companies are starting to drive up their debt level, that's a red flag.
No,
Gotcha.
it's, I love that response, George. We've often been told, as private investors, to look for investments, especially in the fund and investment trust space, that have got a dividend cover of two. But we're now seeing it slowly just being eroded down to 1.1, 1.0. 0.9, and people still sitting there saying, you know, as Henry just pointed out, oh, it's got high yield, it's got high yield. And we're all screaming, going, but what about the cover? What about the fact they've got no cash left? Well, how are they going to keep paying this? And then wallop, the cut comes, and the very secure, hardly moved sort of share price suddenly just goes down, wallop 10%, and then in 15% then the following day when the reality drops.
Yeah, I mean, there's been quite a big one of a case like that recently in the UK market. Yeah, it's actually that sort of behavior can happen for a few reasons. It can happen within a sector because you've got a change in behavior, you've got a change in consumption patterns, you've got a change in technology or whatever. I mean, the sector that I'm thinking about particularly is the alcoholic beverage sector. That's one where there seems to be a change in attitude. People are, I don't know, living healthier lives. They're not drinking spirits particularly so much. So that you can get that sort of thing happening. So yeah, you've just got to watch out. That's a case by case situation.
Okie dokie. Thank you for that. Go on, Henry.
Yes, I mean, I suppose the other element of this that sort of intrigues me is the flip side of all of this. So, right back at the beginning of the conversation, you said that I forget how you phrased it now. Retail investors shouldn't perhaps be exposed to private credit markets. They're not suitable. They're not really suitable investors for this sort of thing, which sort of implies that perhaps there is a suitable holder. Do you think there are positive arguments in favor of private credit as an asset class? You know, what sort of thing do you think it does well, and who do you think ought to be holding it?
If we sort of put a theoretical hat on, what's it good for? Private credit is good for funding private equity. What is private equity good for? It's good for generating the first stage growth, if you like, before a company is big enough or has proven its thesis, its investment thesis, sufficient to get it listed on a public market. So you and the economy desperately needs those things. It needs startups, and the startups by definition are high risk. More than half of startups fail, far more than half of startups fail. So you do want mechanisms to fund startups which are high risk. And from an economy's point of view, you don't actually need many of them to succeed. You can have a very successful economy with 99% of startups failing. If one of them turns into a Microsoft or an Apple, that's enough. So you want this to happen. You want private companies to be started to grow, and a good way to fund that is with private debt. But to do that, if you're going to be the provider of private debt, you've got to be able to pay a lot of attention to where the debt's going, what it's been done for. Frankly, you've got to be a very sophisticated investor. You've got to have deep pockets and long time horizons. And that's generally not the retail space. I think the best places for that sort of investments are the big global sovereign wealth funds, the bigger family offices, high net worth entrepreneurs. You know, entrepreneurs themselves are very good at this. They've often built businesses, they've got rich out of building businesses, they then sell a business, and then they go into being angel investors. So they look for other younger entrepreneurs to sponsor. That can be very successful, but that's not a retail market.
That's a really good response. I like that a lot.
There isn't much joke. Sorry, go on, Henry.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I suppose there's a sort of follow-up to that, which is, and I think I know the answer to this, but do you think that private credit has fundamentally been overdone because of this overregulation of banking? And it's sort of pushed too much capital into that market, which is now seeking investors that it's just got too big for its own good, sort of thing.
Yes, I mean, to put in a single
In a
word, I would say
nutshell.
yes, I do. I think the banking system is overregulated in all sorts of ways, and it's become overly risk averse. And it is, and especially in the UK, I think it is strangling growth
Gotcha.
because of that. And that's coming through in all sorts of different channels. Like, you hear a lot of smaller entrepreneurs, even bigger ones sometimes, talking about the difficulty of opening a bank account. Just
Shouldn't be the case.
simple mechanical things that need to happen in an economy that you can't get done, or you can't get done quickly. So, yeah, I think we desperately need a big deregulation wave.
And what would that look like, George, in the sense of the first sort of steps that would be required? Because what I'm concerned about is that we've got this bubbling debt that's already there. The deregulation will probably optimize that somehow so that the debt gets spread and, like you said, gets repackaged somehow and
Yeah,
maybe put in the wrong places.
this is the great conundrum with this, because what will tend to happen when we, as this new problem emerges, the regulator will tend to respond with, we need another set of regulations because clearly there's a problem. What they won't do is go back and go, well, we've got a problem in this sector because we overregulated that sector. It's a really difficult thing to sell to the public and to the mindset of a regulator that there's a problem and we need to do less of what we're doing rather than more. So I'm not optimistic that that's going to happen. I throw it out there because I think it should happen, not
Yes, no, I
because I
appreciate
expect
that.
it to happen.
It's
No,
almost more of a, you need to redo the regulations you've got rather than simply adding more on top.
Yes, I mean, we see this in all sorts of aspects of government regulation and government law. There's a problem, knife crime.
Whether you are an experienced or new investor, you know how valuable it is to conduct portfolio enhancing analysis and to have easy access to data that will give you the edge. As a Twin Peaks Investing podcast listener, you can access an exceptional offer, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. This special Twin Peaks offer is available to new subscribers only, and you can subscribe using the promo code TWINPEETS. The incredible and exclusive offer means that monthly subscribers will get their second month free and annual subscribers will get their 13th month free. Sign up and subscribe today using the Twin Peaks promo code and you can save up to £69. Visit sharescope.co.uk for further details and subscribe to the investing and trading analysis and data you need.
The government then says, oh, we need a new regulation to ban this particular type of knife. Well, that particular type of knife was never allowed. So let's not pretend we need a new law. You need the existing law correctly and enforced. So
Implemented.
that's the sort of thing. There's a tendency to mask a mistake in applying regulations with, oh, we need a new one,
Well,
when
you won't
actually.
get stabbed with a knife, it'll be a pair of scissors.
Yeah, I do think we need a deregulation wave, but there's, as far as I can see, there's no appetite or even really a discussion of that point going on in the political debate at the moment. So I think we've got to wait a long time for that idea to come back into vogue.
Gotcha. And I suppose my final set of questions really are about next steps for investors. So we've touched on this idea of sort of inflation-linked assets, real assets that the government can't just magic more out of thin air. Thinking about particular companies that you might have invested in, are there any disclosures, accounting notes, company reports, or particular things that investors could look out for that might signal particular exposure to the private credit markets?
That one I'm gonna have to pass on. I cannot think of an easy way to identify this. The only thing I can say is you can identify the sectors that might have
Yes.
it,
Yeah.
which are the sectors that tend to invest money for other people. So certain fund managers, certain insurance companies, certain pension funds, but the pension funds are generally not listed, so that's a moot point. But other than that, no, I can't really give you an
That's
easy
fair.
one
And to
there.
be fair, if it was easy, then everybody would have avoided it by now, and there wouldn't necessarily be the problem. But what do you think? There are some signs, but it was interesting when Peter started this thread on Twitter. I think it was about a week ago, and he called me up and he said, "Oh, look, no one's talking about this." And I challenged him on that and said, "I've been reading stories about private equity issues for about a year and private credit issues for about 6 months. So people are talking about it, but it seems to be the financial commentariat as opposed to the average man on the street."
I'm very pleased you made that point, because in the run-up to the global financial crisis, or actually in the aftermath, once the global financial crisis had happened, the commentary in the press and the commentary from economists was all, why did nobody see this coming? Why was there no discussion? And I can tell you, I was working on one of the big trading floors in one of the big banks at the time, in the periods up to this. The whole city knew about it. Everybody was talking about the problem ahead of time. It was not a surprise. I wrote a book about it. It was not a surprise. Lots of people saw it coming, and lots of people have seen the private credit problems coming. That doesn't mean that you don't get a tipping point when it actually matters, but it's not, this is not, this is not going to be a surprise. It's for some
Got
reason,
it.
it's the way it happens. You get lots. In fact, I think there was a tweet this morning, or maybe last night, that I thought summed it up quite nicely. Somebody made the sort of wry comment, "Oh, I wish an extra couple of thousand people had warned me about private credit." And that sort of sums it up. It's nice. The first 2,000 weren't enough. We needed 3,000. There are a lot of people talking about it.
I love that. I mean, it reminds me of that parable of the guy that drowns in the flood, and he gets to the gate to Saint Peter and he says, "God, how could you let this happen? I've lived a good life my whole life. How could you let me drown?" And God says, "Well, I sent a rowboat and you didn't get in it, and I sent the weather warning and you didn't pay any attention to it. And there was a thunderstorm beforehand and you ignored it, and then the flood came and you drowned. What are you doing here?"
There's a little
Love
bit of that.
that. That George, I'm conscious that we've asked you loads of questions, but I also want you to share with us, unless anybody's got another question regarding the private credit markets, etc., to tell us a bit more and to educate individuals as to the philosophy behind. You mentioned startups, starting your own vehicle, which is Equitable Investments, and your investment thesis for it. You've been running it now for 10 years. Just give us a little synopsis on that, please.
In a word, I'll sum it up with one word: Darwin, Darwinian. We take a very Darwinian approach to the investment markets, and by that I mean adapt to survive. So we're an active manager, and we mean that. We do move the investments around, we change them. I think one of the things that's happened as a consequence of Warren Buffett's success, and I wouldn't take anything away from Warren Buffett. He really is the greatest of all time, if you like. He's done a phenomenal job. But what goes with the Warren Buffett story is this idea that his ideal holding period is forever.
River.
So you get a consequence that a lot of even active managers feel they shouldn't change their positions, and they must hang on to them. So you make an investment decision, and you try to claim that that investment decision can be right for forever in the future. Now, I think that's actually a very pessimistic view of the world. Because if you're doing that, what you're saying at the same time is there aren't going to be new opportunities arising, there aren't going to be new innovations, and there aren't going to be any new risks emerging either. So the idea that you can make an investment decision now and it be right in 5, 10 years' time, I think is a fantasy. It's a mistake. So I think we do need to adapt to survive. And these days, the trading costs are relatively low. We can move the investment portfolio around relatively cheaply. So that's what we do. So yeah, we do have a Darwinian approach. We sort of see the financial markets as an ecosystem of competing assets. And we try to adapt the portfolio to changing circumstances. So, I mean, it's not rocket science. You can see what's happening in the world at the moment. Energy prices are going up. We've put more energy exposure into the funds because we look at the world, we look at what's going on in the Middle East, and we suspect this problem is going to run for longer than is anticipated. And potentially, even if it's quickly fixed, it might have shocked the world into a higher rate, a regime
Higher
of
for
higher
longer.
energy prices, which is, when I see a situation like that, and I look at the energy sector, and it's already trading at very cheap multiples compared to some of the more exotic sectors that are trading on huge multiples and require huge growth. I look at that and I go, well, that looks like a safer option with good upside. So that's our approach.
Brilliant. Now we've got the likes of BP and Shell. I think I own BP. I'm not sure if Henry does or if he owns one or the other, but they're now trading at multi-year highs and all-time highs or there or thereabouts, not far off. So they're doing extremely well. George, can you just expand on the portfolio for Equitable Investments, please, regarding concentrated portfolio or is it diversified? And as you said, you're very opportunistic in the sense of looking at what the catalysts are for sectors of the market, which I
It's
love as well.
relatively concentrated. I think at the moment we've got about 28 names, 28 investments in the portfolio. I mean, you can go onto the website and see some of them. I'll give you a clue as to my thinking. I said we're interested particularly in assets that the government can't print. Our biggest holding at the moment and has been for well over a year and has done very well for us is a big gold mining company.
Hard assets, yep. Like
So,
that.
we have quite a lot of exposure to the mining sector. We have a lot of exposure to the energy sector. We've recently reduced our exposure to the banking sector. Banks actually should do well out of this, what I call a monetization or a debasement, monetary debasement trade or process over the long run. But right now, I'm a little concerned of the connections to the private credit sector that we've just talked about. So we're being a bit more cautious on the banks at the moment. But as I say, we're adaptive. We do change. We may revisit the banking sector if we decide that those connections are not as bad as we thought. And that's because if you're inflating money, you're creating more money. There's no better industry that's connected to the volume of money than banking.
Thanks. Yeah. So
So
that's just helped Henry take a deep breath in because he's exposed to the banks, I think. So he's quite
I
happy with his choices
am.
there in
No,
that sector. So.
we've had big bank investments last year, and I think again, it's a sector that's structurally much cheaper than the sexy sectors that everybody is looking at, the Mag 7 and the data centers and that sort of thing.
It is.
Exactly.
It's
So.
also a little bit of a black box, and I wrote an article a few years ago that, if you're going to invest in financials to some extent as a retail investor, you just have to rely on clever people doing clever things, and at some point, occasionally, that goes wrong. And it turns out the clever people did some very not clever things, and you're left holding the bag.
That's a very, very fair assessment.
Sorry.
Sorry, go on, Peter.
Sorry, George, with regards to the Equitable investment you've got running, that you're the chief investment officer for and founded, how would an ordinary individual like myself and Henry and others that are listening actually access your fund and the resilience fund, and where would they find it, please?
It's listed on all of the major platforms. So you can find it on Hargreaves Lansdown. You can find it on AJ Bell, Interactive Investor. You can put it into your ISA. I've got my ISA invested in it, funnily enough, as you would expect.
Good to hear. Yeah.
And
Eat
my
your own
kids,
cooking. Yeah. And
and my kids,
this is your Equitile Resilience Fund, I take it?
that's the one. That's the one.
Yes.
Yeah. So yes, it's and the purpose of the name resilience, it's the resilience idea is that we adapt to a changing world, so that we're resilient
Absolutely.
to change. That's what we're trying to achieve. First thing we're trying to do is beat inflation, and beat inflation by a wide margin, because that's actually what everybody needs from their investments. You can talk about tracking an index, you can talk about outperforming the FTSE, you can talk about outperforming the S&P 500 or whatever. They're all sort of what I would call an intermediate goal. What you really need is to have the real value of your money going up over time, so that your assets are growing faster than your cost of living. And that's what we're trying to do.
And you
Fantastic.
look to
Love
have
that.
done it very well. I'm just on your website at the moment. Year-to-date performance of 11%, 12.8% annualized return since inception. That's really quite astounding.
We've done well. Thank you.
Yeah. It's done brilliantly, Henry.
There's a
It's amazing
lot
he's
of
on the
our
show, Henry.
audience. Yeah,
Yeah,
there's a
winners on
lot
the
of our
show.
audience that would give their left leg for returns like that.
Well,
10 years,
it's on the
exceptional.
platforms. You're welcome.
Go bother your brokers, ladies and gents.
Brilliant. No, I love that. I'm conscious that Henry's got one big final question for you, George. We've had you on here for nearly an hour. I've got to just take a little pause here and break and thank all of our listeners that have been giving us feedback and supporting us on this podcast. Henry and I are currently supporting a fundraise for our dear friend Mark Bentley, who I know you would have known as well, George. That was from ShareSoc and other shareholder rights movements in the past. So we're currently on £1,370 that we've raised thus far year to date, for those wonderful listeners of ours that have already made donations. For those of you that haven't yet, you still can do. We're going to run this until December 31st or thereabouts of 2026. If you can visit www.justgiving.com/page/TwinPeaksInvestingPodcast2026, you can make a donation there. And we're going to support the FT Financial Literacy and Inclusion Campaign supported in schools to help others get educated on all things that matter regarding financial education, which is part of what we're doing here every single podcast, and generating the podcast freely for everyone to digest and learn from. And that's why I reached out to George to get him on this show to try and educate myself. I've been awfully quiet on this podcast because I'm sat there going, didn't know that, didn't know that. Thank you, George. Didn't know that. So it's been absolutely wonderful to have you on the show, George, and thank you ever so much for sharing your fantastic 30-year plus insights with us regarding the market, stocks and asset classes, which we should be educating ourselves. Everyone should be educating themselves on. Henry, over to you for the final question, please, sir.
The final question. Well, George, you've been an absolute star. So thank you ever so much for all your wisdom on this episode. My final question for you is this: if you had to leave our audience with a single principle for navigating the areas we've discussed today sensibly, what would it be? Should they simply avoid it, understand it better, or be much more skeptical of apparently smooth returns?
Oh, be very skeptical of smooth returns. The most famous case of that, of course, is Madoff. That particular Ponzi scheme exhibited very smooth returns over several decades, and it was a fraud. You should actually be reassured by a bit of volatility in the returns. So I would say that's something you need to learn to accept and almost embrace. So yeah,
I love that.
that will be one
I love
piece of
that.
advice.
Thank you ever so much, George.
Okay. Thank you, Henry, Peter. Thank you very much.
Please stay on the call once we conclude this. I'm just going to say my goodbyes, but don't switch off when we close off, George.
Okay.
George, is there one last thing you want to share? You've absolutely smashed it. It's been absolutely wonderful to have you on here, and I'm very much hoping that we secure you coming on to the Investor Summit in August. Sorry, on 18th of September of this year. I'm putting it out there now. I've not shared this with anybody else yet, other than Henry, but it's actually going to be happening. But we're having the Investor Summit in London again, folks, on the 18th of September. So you can visit the Investor Summit website and have a look on there on that page. But before you go, George, is there one thing that you would like to share or one more thing you'd like to add that Henry and I haven't covered in the past hour or so of speaking with you, please?
Honestly, your questions have been fabulous. I think you've covered a whole range of things. A single thing. No, I think we've done it. You've drained everything I've got.
I think we've done a good job between the three of us then. That's awesome. I really appreciate that. So very, very, very kind of you. Now, for those that want to go and take the deep dive, please go and visit all the choice bookshops and also online bookstores for George's book, In the Origin of Financial Crises. You'll be able to find that book. And you've got some others as well, George, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's another one called Fixing Economics.
Fixing economics, okay.
That one, personally, I think that one's actually more interesting. It's more fun. But the Origin of Financial Crisis talks much more to what we've been talking about now, and the problem in the capital markets. Fixing Economics is more broad, talking about why, as I call it, economics is a failed science and it needs to be re-engineered.
Brilliant. So there's two fantastic books for you, global listeners, to go and investigate and purchase by Dr. George Cooper, founder and chief investment officer of Equitile Investments. George, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on. Henry, you've absolutely smashed it as per usual, mate. So thank you for being fantastic co-host on here. We'll not keep you from your posh dining out evening much longer. George, I'll look forward to speaking to you just shortly after we've shut this down.
Okay.
For all of our global listeners, please, please, please give us a retweet, a follow. Follow George on at X George Cooper on X. And also you can find him, I think, on LinkedIn, and also go and visit the website as well for Equitile Investments. From me and Henry, thank you very much for your support. And we look forward to hearing your feedback. Please follow the accounts of George Cooper and visit the website. And we will see you again in 2 weeks' time, which will be towards the end of March. Take care. God bless you all. Bye-bye for now.
Twin Peaks Investing Podcast is brought to you in association with ShareScope, the UK's number one investment data and analysis software for private investors and traders. Visit shareScope.co.uk and discover the advantage.